All right, buckle up for a deep dive, folks. We're going way back to 1969, a case that still echoes in courtrooms today, or Tulare v. Teachers Retirement Board. This one really makes you think about contracts, you know? Like, what does it even mean to truly understand one?
Yeah, it's fascinating. Or Tulare basically throws this question out there. Can someone totally get a contract, like, intellectually, but because of mental illness, they don't actually have the capacity to, like, truly consent?
And, spoiler alert, the answer is yes. Huge deal for all you legal eagles out there. But okay, before we get all lawyery on you, let's talk about Grace or Tulare, the woman at the center of it all. Picture this. You're a teacher, 40 plus years you've dedicated, loving husband by your side, and bam, involutional psychosis turns your whole world upside down.
It really is a cruel thing, this involutional psychosis. Yeah. Often hits women right in midlife. We're talking serious depression, anxiety, just total agitation, even hallucinations sometimes. Imagine trying to make any kind of rational decision in that state.
Right. Talk about a punch in the gut. And in the middle of all this, Grace makes a choice about her retirement benefits. Seems rational on the surface. She picks a plan that gives her the most money while she's alive. But it cuts her husband out completely after she's gone. So was this calculated, or was it, a consequence of her illness?
That's what kicked off the legal battle. Her husband, he takes it to court, argues she wasn't in her right mind when she made that change. And get this, this was not some easy case. Lower courts, they were totally split on it.
Like a legal tug of war, huh?
Absolutely. So the trial court, they hear Grace's testimony, they see how bad her condition was, and they side with the husband, say those changes to the plan, they're void. She couldn't truly grasp what she was doing.
Makes sense. But then the appellate division comes in swinging, right?
Yeah, they wanted hard proof. Said just having a diagnosis shouldn't automatically toss out a contract. Needed clearer evidence that Grace didn't understand the whole nature of what she was changing.
So we got two courts, two totally different views, and this big question hanging over everything. Does mental illness, even if you seem to get the contract, does it affect your ability to, like, really enter into that agreement? And that's where the heavy hitter steps in. The New York Court of Appeals, top court in the state. They got to settle this.
And what they did, it was groundbreaking. They didn't shy away from mental illness being complicated. They acknowledged that, you know, modern psychiatry, it sees these things in a much more nuanced light. Someone like Grace, they could get the contract on an intellectual level, but still lack the capacity to make a genuinely sound decision.
Right. Like, the mind isn't just on or off. You can be functioning in some ways, but completely messed up in others. And those messed up parts, they affect your choices, even when you think you're being totally rational.
Exactly. And the court, they recognize that Grace's involutional psychosis, it could have totally distorted her thinking. She might have understood the words, but did she truly get what it meant to cut her husband out? Like, the real world impact of that.
So they pushed the whole understanding of capacity way beyond did they get it. It became, could they actually act in their own best interest, given their mental state? Huge shift.
Absolutely. And get this, they took it a step further. Pointed out that retirement systems, they're not just your typical cold contracts. They have a duty, they said, to protect their members, especially those vulnerable because of things like, you know, mental illness. Voiding Grace's choice wouldn't hurt the system financially, they argued. It would just ensure her husband, who she intended to benefit, actually got those benefits like originally planned.
It's like they were saying, hey, we're not just playing with words here. We're dealing with real people's lives.
Exactly. And to lay it all out, they turn to, well, you're familiar with it, the restatement test. Classic tool in contract law. It's got this two-part approach, helps figure out if a contract should be void because of mental incapacity.
Okay, so break it down for us. What are these two parts? What makes this test so important?
Okay, so this restatement test, it really digs into whether someone like Grace could actually make a binding agreement, you know? The first part, it looks at whether, because of mental illness, the person couldn't act reasonably about the whole transaction. It's not just did they understand the words, it's could they actually weigh those words against their own best interest.
So, like, you can't just repeat that contract back and call it a day. You got to be able to process it, get the implications, mm-hmm. and then actually make a decision that, like, a reasonable person would want for themselves.
Exactly. Think of it this way. You got a case. Someone with bipolar disorder, right? In a manic state, they sign away their life savings. They understood the contract itself, sure, but their judgment, totally clouded by their condition. That's what this first part is getting at.
Wow. Yeah, that's a powerful example. Makes you realize how a mental illness can just, I don't know, twist your thinking, even when you think you're being totally logical. Okay, so second prong of the test. What's that all about?
That one asks, Did the other party know, or should they have known, about the person's mental illness? If they did, then the contract gets shaky. Remember, Grace Ortolaire, there were records, proof of her psychosis. The retirement board, they had this info, makes her decision to change those benefits, well, even more questionable.
Yeah, like if you're playing poker and you know the other guy has a tell, you can't just pretend you didn't see it and win because of his bad move.
Exactly. Ortolaire put those retirement systems on notice. Can't ignore signs of a member's mental illness possibly messing with their choices. Big deal for lawyers like you, too. Shows how important it is to really dig into mental health evidence, any contract case.
So it's not just about the words on paper. It's about the whole picture. The person's state of mind, was everyone acting in good faith? It's like a whole new layer to contract law.
You could say that. Now, before we move on, let's touch on Justice Jason's dissent. He brought up a good point. Could this ruling open up, like, a can of worms? Anyone regrets a contract, they claim mental distress to get out of it.
Yeah, the slippery slope argument. Oh, I was stressed when I signed that mortgage, so it doesn't count.
That's the worry. But remember, the Court of Appeals, they weren't saying any distress invalidates things. They focused on serious mental illness like psychosis that really impairs judgment. We're not talking about, like, buyer's remorse or having a bad day.
So the bar is high.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Got to protect people who are vulnerable, but you can't just dismantle the whole idea of contracts, right?
Right. It's all about balance. That's one reason why Ortolaire is so important. It didn't just settle one fight. It gave us a whole new way to think about mental capacity. More nuanced, more compassionate.
It's like they opened a door to a whole new legal world, one where we got to consider the human mind, not just the legal jargon. But okay, let's shift gears a bit. We've been in the theory zone. What about Ortolaire in action? How to change things for lawyers dealing with these mental capacity cases?
It was a wake-up call for sure. Showed everyone you gotta look deeper, beyond the contract, into the person's mind. Lawyers became more like investigators, gathering evidence, talking to experts, really building a full picture of their client's capacity.
So it's not enough to just know the law anymore. You gotta get the human side, the psychology behind it all, and know what evidence actually holds up in court.
Exactly. Imagine you represent someone who signed a contract while, say, super depressed. Or Talia tells you, medical records, that's key. You need the diagnosis, testimony from mental health pros who treated them, firsthand accounts from people who saw the changes.
It's like a puzzle, right? Each piece adds to the picture, helps the court really see how the illness affected the person's ability to, you know, contract. Expert witnesses sounds like they're crucial here.
Oh, absolutely. They're the bridge between, like, the complex world of mental health and the legal standards you got to meet. They explain the illness, how it might have shown up in your client's actions. Did it mess with their understanding of what they were doing?
So it's not just opinions. They're giving context, analysis, so the judge and jury can make a good decision. It's about making sure the system sees the person, not just the signature.
That's it, exactly. And Ortolaire also showed how important proactive legal advice is. You know your client has mental health history. Be extra careful advising them about contracts, any legal stuff.
Thinking ahead, right. Maybe recommend a capacity evaluation before they sign anything big. Just in case.
Precisely. Protecting your client, making sure their rights are solid, especially when mental illness might be in the mix.
So Ortolaire changed the game. Not just the law itself, but how lawyers approach these situations. More thorough, more sensitive to the whole mental health aspect. But let's zoom out a sec. We've been all about contract law. This ruling, it goes beyond that, right?
Oh, definitely. The ideas in Ortolaire, they've been used everywhere. Estate planning, guardianship, even criminal law.
So someone writing a will while super depressed, or a defendant's ability to stand trial, Ortolaire can come into play there too.
Exactly. Mental illness isn't just one legal issue. It affects people's decisions across the board.
It's like Ortolaire was this pebble that caused ripples throughout the legal system. How we think about mental capacity, it's all been touched by it. But before we wrap up this part, gotta talk about the ethical side for lawyers. These cases, they come with unique challenges, right?
Huge question. Any lawyer dealing with this stuff should be thinking about it. Biggest challenge. Balancing that duty to fight for your client with, you know, protecting them at the same time.
Not just winning, but making sure what you're doing is actually good for them in the long run, even if it means advising against a certain move.
Right. Sometimes winning the case might actually hurt your client's mental state their whole life. It's a tough line to walk. It takes a lot of thought, understanding the law and the person.
And then there's confidentiality. Lawyers, gotta keep things private, that's the rule. But with mental illness, that can get messy.
Oh, yeah. Imagine your clients share something that could hurt their case. Or they say they might be a danger to themselves or others. Confidentiality versus preventing harm. Tough call.
Sounds like you need more than just legal skills here. You need empathy, you need to understand mental illness, the whole picture.
Couldn't agree more. That's what makes this area of law so tough, so important. It's not just about laws and courtrooms. It's about people, their lives, their basic rights.
Well, that wraps up part two of our Ortolere exploration. We've covered a lot, from that restatement test to the real-world stuff lawyers face. But our deep dive, not over yet. Join us in part three. We're jumping into the digital age. How does Ortolere apply to online contracts, social media, AI? Things are about to get really interesting. Welcome back, everyone. It's wild to think about a case from 1969, Ortolere, and how much it still matters today, especially with all this tech stuff happening. Back then, the internet was, what, science fiction? Now it's like our whole lives. So how does a case from the dinosaur age apply to, well, now?
Yeah, it's the million-dollar question, right? Keeps legal folks up at night. The heart of Ortolere, the idea that mental illness messes with capacity, even if someone seems to get it, that duty to protect people, those are timeless. But the digital world, it throws some wrenches in the gears.
All right, so let's catch those wrenches. What are we talking about specifically? Like, what makes the digital world tricky when we're trying to figure out capacity using Ortolere as our guide?
Think about it, how we do things online. Info overload, gotta make decisions fast, clicking agree on terms we don't even read. How do you tell if someone's really consenting in that environment? What about mental health conditions that might make them, I don't know, more susceptible to manipulation or just bad at processing all that info?
Right. It's not like sitting down with your lawyer, taking your time with a contract online. It's all bam, bam, bam. Could be really bad for someone whose judgment is already shaky because of mental illness.
Exactly. And then there's social media, oversharing, saying stuff you might not offline. What happens when that ends up in court? Was someone in control when they hit post? What if they were manic or super depressed?
Yeah. Big questions about privacy, consent, what it means to say something online. It's not just words anymore. And AI, too. That's a whole other beast. How does Ortolere even fit in when algorithms are deciding stuff about us, even our mental health?
Oh, yeah, we're just scratching the surface there. Can AI really grasp human behavior, the messiness of mental illness, the ethical stuff? Kind of scary to think a machine might decide your legal rights.
Uncharted territory, for
Yeah.
sure. So where do we go from here? Law, mental health, tech, all colliding. What should lawyers be thinking about in this crazy new world?
If I had a crystal ball, right. But I think it's all about working together, coming up with new ideas, being really careful ethically. Lawyers, mental health pros, tech people, ethicists, everyone needs to be at the table. How do we take old ideas like Ortolere and make them work in this world that's changing so fast?
Got to be proactive, right? Figure out the problems before they hit us. Come up with new laws, new ethical guidelines. Can't let tech leave the law in the dust.
Exactly. Tech should be helping people, protecting them, not making things worse for those who are already struggling. And that goes back to what Ortolere was saying. The system has to protect those who can't protect themselves. Even more important now, with all this tech stuff.
It's like a reminder, huh? Law isn't just about winning or losing, it's about people. Their lives, their rights. And as tech changes everything, the law has to keep up, be a force for good.
Well said. Ortolere, it might be from the past, but it's got lessons for the future. The law has to evolve, meet people where they are, protect everyone, no matter their mental state.
Great way to wrap it up. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. Hope you learned something new, got you thinking about this crazy intersection of law, mental health, and tech. It's a wild world out there, and we're all figuring it out together.